Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
Okay, it's our tradition before we hear from our speaker today to go around the room and say our names. If I may, I'll begin. My name is Roy.
My name is Henry.
I'm Greg.
I'm Tom.
My name is Gary.
Francisco.
Dennis.
Yao.
Rob.
Don.
Maya.
Julian.
My name is Joe.
I'm Richard.
Matthew.
I'm Hal.
Laurie.
Risha.
I'm Tim.
Jack.
Seamus.
David.
My name is Cass.
David.
I'm Brad.
My name is Ray.
I'm Shelton.
Jay.
Peter.
Rob.
Michael.
I'm David.
Hart.
And I'm Dhanadasa.
It is my pleasure to introduce Dhanadasa, who has been practicing with the San Francisco Buddhist Center community since 1993 and was ordained in 2011. His current area of exploration is the cultivation of metta, universal loving kindness, as a response to all the hatred, discrimination, and bigotry in the world out there. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha describes mindfulness as the direct path to liberation. What is liberation? What is mindfulness? And how does mindfulness lead to liberation? During the next 4 weeks in the month of January, we'll be exploring the four spheres of experiences described in the Satipatthana Sutta: the body, the heart, the mind, and the teachings of the Buddha. We will also explore the relationship between mindfulness and the three jewels of Buddhism: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Dhanadasa invites us to consider the month of January as a month-long practice period, a time to put a bit more intentionality, discipline, and energy into this beautiful and mysterious process of transformation. Welcome, Dhanadasa.
Thank you, Roy. What time should I wrap up?
At 10 till.
Fantastic. Well, Happy New Year, everyone. Welcome. And I'm so delighted to be here. I've actually been looking forward to this for months. So I'll be here with you for the entire month of January. As Roy alluded to, we'll be talking about kind of the relationship between two sets of lists. Like in Buddhism, there's all sorts of lists, tons of lists. So here, on the left-hand side, we've got the mind, the heart, the body, which are the three of the spheres of experience that are alluded to in what's called the Satipatthana Sutta, which I'll say more about. And on the right-hand side, we've got the Sangha, the Dharma, and the Buddha, which are what are called the three jewels of Buddhism. Before I get into the material here, I'd like to say something about the idea of a practice period, practice month. So I thought January would be a fantastic time to do this because a lot of people, including myself, would tend to end the year looking back, 2016, and looking forward to 2017. And I know a lot of people like to make New Year's resolutions, New Year's intentions. What would I like to bring to fruition in this year looking forward? So in January, a lot of people tend to be very bright-eyed and bushy-tailed about the future. And I think particularly with what's going to happen this month with the inauguration of our new president, it is so incredibly important that we manifest as much peace, joy, understanding, patience, equanimity, and also action so incredibly important that we do this. So I've noticed this in myself, as well as in a lot of other people I talk with, that something has been activated on both ends of this spectrum. I came across this expression of make America hate again. And I was really quite struck by this little turn of phrase, you know, make America hate again. And if you just watch the news, it just feels like that's all you see. That's all I see. It's just so vitriolic. It's so toxic. And it's so easy just to turn away from that. Just, I just can't deal with it. Which, of course, solves nothing. That solves nothing. So it's so important that we actually become much more clear about what it is that we want to individually and collectively manifest in the world, to bring to the world. And we bring to the world something manifests in every single interaction we have with both ourselves and also with everyone else. So it's so important to keep this in mind. So in the month of January, what I'd like to suggest is that we consider this collectively as a practice period, a practice month. So there's some very important questions just to become a bit more clear about. Well, what am I doing here? Why do I come to this center? Why do I practice Buddhism? Why do I meditate? What's the point? What's my intention here? And with these sorts of questions, it's very easy to come away with kind of canned responses which may or may not be alive in your heart. Well, meditation makes me a better person. I'm more calm. And, you know, when I'm more calm, I behave better. I'm nicer, that sort of thing. And these things are all very true. They're very, very important. But in fact, what Buddhism is pointing at is actually something much, much deeper than just being a better, nicer person. What Buddhism is actually pointing at is it's inviting us to actually see the root of suffering. So suffering, this is a translation of the word dukkha, and I prefer the translation of stress and anxiety. So I'll restate that. Buddhism is inviting us to actually see clearly the root of stress and anxiety. And then when we can see that clearly, then there's actually an opportunity to undo that stress and anxiety. Buddhism presents this opportunity of actually the liberation from stress and anxiety. So we'll be getting into this as well. Like, what is liberation? Okay, so I'll say a bit more about the practice period at the end. So now I'll get into a quick introduction about the Satipatthana and the Three Jewels. So the Satipatthana Sutta, Sati is typically translated as mindfulness, and Patthana is one translation, a modern translation of Patthana, is placing close to. So Satipatthana, what this teaching refers to, it's the Buddha giving instructions on what it is that's important to pay attention to. And of course, it's the body, heart, mind, as well as dhammas. And I'd like to just read a passage, it's just a sentence from the Satipatthana Sutta. And these are from the words of the Buddha. He describes the Satipatthana as thus. This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha, or suffering, and discontent, for acquiring the true method for the realization of nirvana, namely the four Satipatthanas. So there was a lot there. I'll just repeat the first part. This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, and for the disappearance of suffering and discontent. The disappearance of suffering and discontent. It's a direct path. So this is a very, very powerful teaching. It's a direct path for the dissolving of stress and anxiety. So these four spheres of experience, we're just going to focus on three, really, which is the body, heart, mind. And we're actually going to do this in reverse order. We're going to start with the mind, and then we'll move on to the heart, and then we'll move on to the body. And then I'll just relate that to each one of these three jewels, the Sangha, the Dharma, and the Buddha. Okay, so concerning the mind, Buddhism, it's fundamentally a training of the mind. That's what's being presented in Buddhism. It is a training of the mind. And according to Buddhism, everything that we experience, love, hate, anger, frustration, joy, sorrow, everything we experience, it's all mind-made. We create our worlds with our minds. We create our experience with our narratives, with the stories of our lives, with the story of me. So these stories that we tell, they run very, very deep. Very deep indeed. So I'd like to share with you a personal example of one of the stories of my life that has had a profound effect on how I experience the world. And I'm going to use this with a metaphor, a symbol. So the story of my life, actually, I'll call it my past life, because it's no longer really my life presently. But 20 years ago, this certainly was the case. I live in a castle. My castle is beautiful. It's got big, thick stone walls, very high, 30, 40 feet. There's a moat. Got a big moat. It's filled with crocodiles and alligators and piranhas, all sorts of nasty stuff. And in my castle, everything is perfect. I've got beautiful tapestries on the walls, beautiful furnishings. I have servants, I have a cook, I have people to clean, look after my needs. It's lovely, my castle. I've got a big drawbridge, which I usually keep up, so I can keep out the people that I don't want to see. And everything is just the way I want in my castle. I am the king of my castle. But every once in a while, I feel kind of lonely. I feel kind of isolated. I know. I'll go out to the village. Lower the drawbridge. I go out to the village, to the marketplace, to the tavern, and I mingle with the people. It's very pleasant. It's very nice. But then something happens that I don't like. I look at someone. I don't like the way they look. Someone speaks to me in a tone that I don't like. Something triggers in me, some response of fear. And my response to this is, I'm out of here. I retreat back to my castle, and I pull up the drawbridge, and there's a big sign there that says, "Do not disturb." So for many, many years of my life, this is the way that I lived my life. Whenever difficulty would arise in my life, whenever any event or anything that would trigger a response of fear, for me personally, I would simply retreat into my castle, and I would just wall myself out from the world. I was inaccessible. And there were periods of time in my life where I I had great difficulty returning phone calls. You know, today it's about returning emails. People don't really call anymore. And I would feel oppressed, like when people would call me and leave messages for me. And I would just feel this weight of, oh, now I have to return them. It's a really painful way to live. So, there's something in this story about safety, about protection, about feeling unsafe, sort of the need to protect myself. So with this narrative, I carry this narrative with me all the time. These are invisible glasses from which I view the world. And this narrative affects and colors everything that I see. So, of course, when we are looking for certain things, even if we don't know it, we will have a very strong tendency to see those things. So our experience, our perception, our memories, they're very selective. It's really fascinating when you take a close look at this, how selective our memory tends to be, our way of experiencing the world. So here's another good example, which perhaps some of you may resonate with, is I have a tendency to be very critical of myself and others. So as a result, I will tend to amplify that which I experience as being negative within myself and within others. And I will tend to not see or downplay the positive aspects of myself and others. Now I can see this tendency. For many years I did not. So, the mind, these stories, the way we interpret our experience, the story of me, actually this runs really, really deep. And there's quite a bit of it that actually may be, most likely, below the surface of our consciousness, kind of lurking down there in our subconscious, lurking in our unconscious, things which we may not be fully aware of. So it's very important to have a sense of how we operate in the world and how we experience the world and how our minds color our experience.
I'm going to write something up here. So training the mind. So according to Buddhism, one of the absolutely primary ways of training the mind is meditation. So I'm going to put a list up here. Traditionally called five hindrances. So I'm going to talk a bit about meditation here and the value of meditation. Five hindrances. So this is the traditional name given to these five hindrances, but I'm going to use a slightly more clunky translation, which is the five habitual responses to our experience that binds us to stress and anxiety. Slightly more descriptive. Five hindrances. Five habitual responses to our experience that binds us to stress and anxiety. So if you look up in the internet this, you won't find much of it. Look this up. This is what you'll find. Five hindrances. So these five hindrances, the center is doubt. On the left and right, not necessarily on the left and right, but I like to do this quite spatially, is here you've got restlessness and anxiety. And over here, you've got what's traditionally called sloth and torpor. Right, so this polarity here, these two poles, is restlessness and anxiety is kind of over amped up. Sloth and torpor, right? So this is energetic on this pole here. And then above and below are desire for sense pleasure and aversion or hatred. Hatred is quite a strong word. Aversion and hatred. So here on this axis, these two polarities, this here's the dynamic of the story of me. So the story of me is, it's all about me. It's very simple. It's all about me. It's all about what I want and what I don't want. It's all about me getting what I want and getting away from what I don't want. That's the story of me. Actually, it's a story of you as well. It's a story of all of us. This here is, I want, I want, I want. This here is, I don't want, I don't want, I don't want. This one over here is, God damn it, I'm stuck with what I don't want. I don't like it. Whatever's happening right now, I don't like it. I want to get away from this. Whatever this is. Over here, this is just tuning out. That's just, I just can't deal. Whatever. I'm just going to watch YouTube. Whatever it is. This over here is sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Whatever that means to you. It's just spacing out. And here in the middle, doubt. This one is the one that makes this all run. Makes this all happen. This doubt, this is fundamentally, it's doubt, it's self-doubt. It's doubting our own ability to liberate ourselves from these ways of being. And this doubt runs deep. It runs really, really deep. So these five hindrances, when one meditates, sit back down. So now I'd like to describe to you the process of meditation. Actually, before I do that, let me say one more thing about this. So you may notice that one of these, or perhaps more than one, kind of leaps off this whiteboard at you. Like it's, oh yeah. So people will tend to have, call it their root hindrance. Some place that they tend to inhabit much more so than other places. So this is the really interesting thing about the mind as well, is the mind... we are creatures of habit. Our minds, they tend to move in very habitual ways of thinking. So going back to this idea of a narrative, this narrative, I have tread this narrative so many times of the castle that it has become my reality. So you will notice when you start to look at your mind, at the patterns of your mind, the habitual tendencies of your mind, you will begin to notice certain places that your mind tends to end up. Traditionally, or one image from the tradition is like the grooves of the mind. And there's this one lovely image of water running down a hillside. And it will tend to form a groove. And then all the water will tend to gather in that groove. And the more the water runs down that groove, the deeper that groove becomes. So if we just fall asleep,
our minds will just naturally fall into these habitual ways of being in the world. And we're just going to do the same thing over and over and over again. So that's really emphasizing this word habitual. So now I'm going to say something about meditation, the path of meditation. So in meditation, there is what is described in the tradition as states of concentration. And these are called the dhyanas. These are states of concentration, and there's actually eight dhyanas that are enumerated in the tradition. Eight of these states of consciousness. So I'm going to start with the first dhyana. So I'm now going to describe to you my experience of moving from a distracted mind to a mind that is concentrated, distracted to concentrated. So in this example, my mind is running amok. I've got monkey mind. Tons of thoughts, restless, blah, 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 blah. Just going to sit with that. I'm going to stay with that. I'm going to use the breath. The breathing body is an anchor, is a focus that keeps me in the present moment, keeps me in my senses. And if I can stay with that long enough, the mind will gradually begin to wear itself out. It'll get tired. So I think this image of monkey mind is a very good image. Just a monkey in the jungles, just jumping from tree to tree, all over the place. It's like our minds, very restless, always seeking, always looking for excitement. Well, after a while, that monkey is going to get tired. It's going to stop and sit down and take a nap. And that's kind of what our minds will do. So we can just simply stay with this process. Just watch our minds flitting about, and they'll finally just calm down. That energy will begin to dissipate. And then what happens is this very beautiful process of unification. So this pull of desires and pleasure, aversion, sloth, torpor, restlessness, when we're sitting, it's like, I'd rather not be, and I'm going to do something else, so my back kind of hurts. It's like the push and pull of all of our blah, 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 blah. It's all the blah, blah, blah. All this, it's all the crap that goes on in our minds. Well, when we arrive in this state of concentration, what happens is there is a unification of the mind, a unification of the heart, unification of the body. And what happens is these five hindrances actually dissolve. So the marker of the first dhyana, the first state of concentration, is actually the absence of these five habitual responses to our experience, of these five hindrances. So this is very, very important in terms of training the mind. When one trains the mind, one must pay attention to what is present and also what is not present. So in a state of concentration, what is not present is this. Are these five hindrances. The push and pull of the story of me. This clinging mind, this grasping mind that needs to control everything. What is absent in the first dhyana is this. What is present is this experience of calm abiding. It's just this. This is a lovely image. Entering into a state of concentration, there's a metaphor in the Pali Canon, the teachings of the Buddha. It says, it's as if you've been carrying around a large weight and you suddenly just put it down. It's like,
Another beautiful image is, it's as if you've been carrying around this large debt that's suddenly forgiven. Sense of, or you've been in jail and you're suddenly released. You're suddenly free. So in all these images, there is a sense of freedom. Of just, and this happens. This happens. It happens on happens to me and a lot of people I've talked to, especially on meditation retreats where you're meditating a lot more than you usually do, 4, 6, 8 hours a day. And you begin the retreat. For me, it takes about a day to really settle in. And when I settle in, what happens is I'll notice at some point, like my body will just do this. I'm going to exaggerate. My shoulders will suddenly go. I'll just kind of drop a little bit. Or my face, I notice this in my cheekbones, will just, my face will just become soft. It's like, oh. And it's interesting because when this happens, wait a second, I wasn't even aware that I was holding my shoulders like this. I wasn't aware of the tension in my body. And you only become aware of it when it actually dissolves. You know? So the body softening, it's really quite fascinating. It's this sense of, of something dissolving. You know? So it's fascinating because it's this dissolving, but it's manifesting as a softening of the body. So this is really important from the perspective of the Satipatthana Sutta, of the mind, the heart, and the body. What is being described here is that the mind, the heart, and the body are all deeply connected, deeply interrelated. And in a way, even to talk about them separately doesn't really make sense. We can talk about them in relationship to each other. We could perhaps even say that they are three sides of the same coin, the mind, body, and heart. Right? So we enter into this state of concentration, a sense of calm abiding. So in terms of the qualities of this experience of concentration, there is a sense of resting. There's a sense of just relaxation. There's no more sense of, there's an absence of striving. So sometimes we can get into this, like over-efforting. Like, okay, I've got to meditate every day for 20 minutes. That's my commitment. Okay, kind of grind it out. Check the box. It's kind of a chore. That sort of thing. So when one enters into this state of concentration, the nature of our energy, sloth and torpor, restlessness and anxiety, the nature of our energy actually shifts. So we no longer have to apply this sort of, I'll call it nose to the grindstone discipline. Oh, this is good for me, so I need to be doing this. That's no longer present. It's just this sense of, actually, it's delight in just sitting in contentment with this simple experience of breathing in the body. It's just really beautiful, this experience of concentration. So I'll say a little bit about the second dhyana. So in the first dhyana, our minds are now unified upon our present experience of the breathing body. And there is still thinking associated with this. So there are still thoughts arising in our mind. However, in this state of concentration, the thoughts that are arising are related to our direct experience. They're not random. What am I going to have for dinner? Blah, blah, blah. They're not pulling us in different directions. They're not perturbing the mind. Or we're not going chasing after these thoughts. These thoughts just arise.
And they pass away. They arise and they fade away. So this image of like clouds passing in the sky, these can be like the thoughts that arise in this first dhyana. Now in the second dhyana, what happens, which is a deepening of this concentration, in the second dhyana, actually thoughts, this internal dialogue, the thoughts actually dissolve. And we can enter into a wordless experience. So it's not just like this blank, everything goes blank, like turning off the lights in a room or turning off the power on your computer. It's not like that at all. But rather it's this non-verbal, direct experience of the present moment. It's very rich. It's very alive. This lovely image pops to my mind. I forget who I picked this up from. But it's an image from The Wizard of Oz. The Wizard of Oz. So in terms of people who have never meditated before, it's like, what? Really? What do you kind of describe this deepening progression of concentration. And if you've never touched into this, it may seem quite foreign. So I have no idea what you're talking about, really. So the analogy is, you know, Dorothy, in the beginning of The Wizard of Oz, the world is in black and white. And imagine trying to describe color to Dorothy. She would have no idea what you were talking about. There's a whole world out there that lies beneath this constant chattering mind. Blah, 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 blah. If we can just get beneath that, there's actually this incredible, rich depth of experience. It's all behind that. It's called color. So the moment when Dorothy arrives at Oz, she opens the door, and it's a world of color. Nothing you could have said to her beforehand could have captured that. Words could not have captured that experience of stepping from a black and white world into a world of color. That is simply a direct experience which is beyond words. It's incredibly rich. It's incredibly alive. And this is what stepping into the second dhyana, into this wordless experience, can feel like that. Perhaps not as dramatic, but it's incredibly beautiful, incredibly rich. So, in addition to that, none of this is going on. So when one steps into this state of even a deeper concentration, what also arises, what is also present, is the experience of what's traditionally called sukha, priti and sukha. So priti is typically translated as rapture, and sukha is typically translated as bliss, rapture and bliss. And what these two words are pointing at is actually the experience of the body. It's filling with bliss. The body fills with bliss, the heart fills with bliss, the mind fills with bliss. It's like we're just bathing in this bathtub full of bliss. It's very beautiful, very beautiful. And then what arises after that is what's called a state of equanimity. The state of even-mindedness, of just mental and emotional stability. Just imperturbability. It's as if you're sitting like a mountain. The body like a mountain, the heart as deep as the ocean, the mind as wide as the sky. It accepts all things without judgment. So this is the path of meditation. Why is meditation so important in this process of transformation? Well, obviously there's lots of really delightful things associated with meditation. One pitfall is to think of meditation or to relate to meditation as yet another drug. The world out there is full of hate. I'm just going to meditate. I can bliss out on my own. I don't need any of you people. And it's actually quite common. And this falls into the category of, well, the reason I meditate is because it makes me feel better. Which is continues to reinforce this story of, it's all about me. This is my bliss. This is my rapture. This makes me feel good. And I really couldn't care less about the rest of you. So, I think it's a good thing. I mean, the less stress and anxiety there is in the world, that's a really good thing. It's a really good thing. And it's, there's so much more that Buddhism has to offer. So in terms of what this more is, this is what's traditionally said about meditation, is that in order to actually free ourselves from stress and anxiety permanently, in order to free ourselves permanently, because stepping into these states of concentration, we are freeing ourselves from stress and anxiety temporarily. While we're meditating, while we're immersed in those states, stress and anxiety is suspended temporarily. But there's a way to actually eradicate stress and anxiety, to cut it off at its root. This is what the Buddhist tradition offers. So in terms of how to go about doing this, well, there is the preliminary of cultivating a unified mind. So now we're getting into liberation. Now we're getting into insight. Like, what is insight? What is liberation? And it's really quite straightforward. If your mind is really distracted all over the map, thinking blah, 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 your mind will be so perturbed that it's not going to be able to see insight. It's not going to be able to liberate itself. So the basis for clear seeing, the basis for achieving liberation, is we actually need to have some degree of mental and emotional stability, some degree of unification of the mind. Once we're able to cultivate that skill of a unified mind, then we can actually begin to use the power of the mind to see what is unfolding, to see the nature of our experience and how to go about undoing this. This is very traditional. You may have heard these terms of samatha and vipassana meditation. Samatha is calming the mind, coming, arriving at a place of a unification of the mind. And then from that place of a unified mind, using that unified mind, then we can turn our minds towards vipassana. Vipassana refers to clear seeing, of actually seeing the root of stress and anxiety, and then seeing how to actually undo that root. Samatha vipassana. Okay. Wow. It's 11:48. Well, it's great that we've got 4 weeks together. there's a problem here. I could say, well, till next week. Okay. Got two more minutes.
Practice period. This is something that I've done with a lot of groups, and it's really good fun. I didn't even talk about the Sangha. So this is all about Sangha. So Sangha is a spiritual community. It's practicing together. It's collective practice. Yeah, collective practice is really beautiful. What am I going to write up here? Oh, right. Okay. So this is going to be one of the touchstones for the month. And I wrote this at a previous time I visited here. That which one brings to mind frequently becomes the tendency of the mind. This is a quote from the Buddha. And what I'd like to invite everybody to do during this coming week is to tune into what is called the malleability of mind. The malleability of mind. Our minds are incredibly malleable. For example, if we bring up something in our lives that causes a lot of stress and anxiety, maybe a difficult relationship, difficult job, difficult financial situation, and we just bring that to mind and we dwell on it, that's going to color our entire experience. Yeah? We'll be grumpier, meaner, shorter fuse, that sort of thing. Yeah. Versus if we bring to mind something that's really positive in our lives, that will also have a positive effect upon our experience and the way that we experience ourselves and everybody else. So, in this malleability of mind, this is also mind training to develop good mental habits. Right? So a very good mental habit is cultivating gratitude, that which we're grateful for. And it's very interesting, just forming the intention to cultivate gratitude will have a positive effect. And the more that we cultivate gratitude, the more likely gratitude will arise. So this is what I've done with other groups, where I invite people to form these little text groups of 3 to 5 people, and they're called gratitude text groups. So it's very simple. You get a group of 3 or 5 people, you all exchange your cell phone numbers, and then throughout your day, you just notice, you look for things that bring joy. Actually, very simple things, like the texture of the wood on the floor, or the sound of the rain, the smell of the wet earth, some interaction you had with somebody just brought you some joy. And you just text the group little things that you're grateful for. And I love doing this because whenever I would receive texts from other people about this, it would brighten my heart. Like I would have this vicarious thrill of being delighted by somebody else's delight. And then it would make me look around and go, well, what am I grateful for right now? It's a really interesting space to be in. So I'm not quite sure how we'll kind of organize this. So this is totally optional, and also highly recommended. Totally optional and highly recommended. So if you would like to participate in one of these gratitude texting groups, perhaps after our closing circle, those of us who would like to do that can kind of linger perhaps in the corner of the shrine room over here, and we'll sort of self-organize these little groups. And I would suggest that these groups continue on through the entire month of January. And we'll just begin to notice what this practice, the effect that this practice has on our minds. Yeah. Okay, I should stop now. But thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So some announcements. I'll go ahead and start. Dana is the Pali word for giving. And our suggested donation is $10. Our host today is Mark Hoffheimer. He'll be going around with the Don Bowl. And, of course, it covers our rent here, our newsletter, our speakers, the Larkin Street dinners, mailers, and everything else that comes up for us. And whatever you can give, of course, is greatly appreciated. Mark, right, if you may.
Yes, welcome everyone. There's there's food out on the table. Please help yourself. There's tea, and if you're done with the cup, or you're done with the cup, just put it right in the dishwasher. So we're right by the sink. Some of us meet at 12:30 or so. We head out to lunch at the front door. If you want to sign up, be on our mailing list. There's a piece of paper on the credenza that you can sign up. And I think that's about it. I'll be going on today. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Are there any other announcements? Anyone?
Did you, before we started, because I came sort of late, did you welcome newcomers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. I didn't remember what that.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, let's go ahead and stand up for that.
By the power and truth of this practice, may all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all be free from sorrow and the causes of sorrow. May all never be separated from the sacred happiness which is without sorrow. And may all live in equanimity without too much attachment or too much aversion, believing in the equality of all that lives.
Thank you, gentlemen, for coming today.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.